Thank you for being, and welcome to the Peniel Podcast. I'm Josh, and I know that I know nothing. So I created this podcast to help awaken my spirit. Today I have the joy of interviewing a longtime friend, Aaron Wolf, the president and owner of Adventures Access LLC, an outfitter, backpacking, and guide company based out of Chicago, Illinois, and Asheville, North Carolina. Aaron is a Marine Corps veteran who served in Iraq and now takes people out to commune with nature for a living. Aaron, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Josh. Good to see you.
Sweet, man. Good to see you too. So I wanted to have you on because I think your story is incredibly interesting. And I think it's really cool how you got to where you are today. And I wonder if you saw this path all the way through or not. And I kind of want to trace it because we were friends back in high school. And then, you know, we had some interesting times back in high school. You were the only one of our people to join the armed forces. I wanted to ask you about that decision. What made you join the military? And do you think 18 was old enough for you to make that decision?
All right. Good question. So there are a few things that really led to my decision to join the Marine Corps. I enlisted in 2003. We didn't graduate high school until 2004. So I'm old for our grade. And when 9/11 happened, we were sophomores. We were on our way to second period. And
what class were you going to?
Non-Western Civ with Chris Salaturo.
Yep.
Who has become a great friend of mine in adult life. It's interesting, non-Western Civ, and then at least for me, that's where I kind of wound up.
I was going to physics. But you remember, we all remember.
Right.
In that sort of way. So sorry to interrupt you, but.
All good. So I think at that time I was just going through I wouldn't say like a phase of patriotism, but I think I had an awareness of what, I guess how good it is in America at that time to be American, to have the privileges that we have in this country. So when 9/11 happened, I was really like, holy cow, this is nuts, you know, and then we all go out for gym class and see there's no planes in the skies and things are really different. So I was really diving into my own patriotism, but at the same time, was going down this path of really, I'd say I was complacent with my academics. I was never a strong student. I never like hit the books and, you know, like I'm going to do my homework first so I can go play outside. It was always play outside and homework will happen. So I was going through a time where I I wasn't studious, and the calling to serve was becoming more of an option. And as I progressed in high school through sophomore year and then junior year, I became basically like non-existent in the classroom, emotionally or, you know, I was physically there most of the time, but intellectually I wasn't. And, I ended up thinking, you know what, I'm at a point in my life where I think if I ended up going to college, I won't get into a good college, and two, I will simply just blow all the money that my parents have worked very hard for to send me to college. So I just don't think I'm ready, and I don't think it's good for me to go to college because I think I might come back with a substance abuse problem or a criminal record. I don't know. You just never know. And I just kind of had this awareness to just like, fuck it. I gotta clean myself up. So I enlisted in the Marine Corps because that was, in my opinion, the only branch that was going to get me there. I knew they had the reputation of being the toughest or the best and the physically most difficult and all these things. And I figured that's what I need. So I signed up and I shipped out that summer that we graduated. Actually, on my 19th birthday was my first day at boot camp. So to your question, if 18 is a good age or the right age for folks to enlist. Honestly, I mean, it's really everyone has a different, I guess they're on a different journey. For me, I needed it. But also I was so naive. I carried such a high level of naivety, you know, even through like the next 10 years in my life, just, you know, not like I made decisions and regretted them. It was just, you make decisions and just don't fully weigh what's going to happen next down the road. So for some teenagers, right, 18, 19, you're still a teenager. For some teenagers, they might have some stronger foresight, and maybe that's just not my strength. I'm kind of, you know, live in the moment, act now, ask for forgiveness later kind of lifestyle, maybe. I don't know. So the age of 18, I think, for the most part, I'd say is pretty young. You know, and I think, at least for military service, I don't think there's anything wrong with any other kind of service, if it's Peace Corps or like a Conservation Corps, which I've worked with in the past, like things that you still working together, doing physically challenged work or meaningful work with a group of your peers can be highly transformative. That's what military service is, minus training for war. And so personally, you know, I needed time to mature. I did that in the Marine Corps, but it was also at the same time I was pretty, you know, off, just wasn't, I won't say I wasn't thinking, but it was a big decision. I think I made it in the best judgment. I don't regret it. I had an excellent experience, made some, you know, finest friends, you know, that I have. There's a big difference in serving your country and serving in other ways.
Yeah. So a couple things you said there, and thanks for sharing that.
Sure.
I would say, aren't we all naive at 18? And I think science backs that up, that our brain isn't fully formed till 25. And so you think that you can do a whole bunch of different things, but training for war is the specific thing of service to community that is somehow different than Peace Corps or Conservation Corps or, you know, helping older neighbors take a walk around the neighborhood, which is needed work and could help encourage the community. But there's something inherently different about training for war than everything else. And that 18 might be too young for making that decision to train for war, because it's an inherently different thing than anything else. And I guess, why is it inherently different? And do you think, like, for instance, Israel, and we've both visited Israel, has required military service of all of its citizens. And do you think putting all of its citizens, or the specific ones that go in, into training for war at age 18 helps shape and form their ideas and worldview in a way which might not benefit society as a whole?
Well, you know, I can't speak for the Israeli experience in sending all of their teenagers off to serve. For specifically, I'll say, when I did visit, and all the soldiers that I did meet, I've stayed not in close touch with, but, you know, we are friends and I keep up with them. They're all successful in the private sector, living their lives. So it's interesting to see them thrive in that way. It's the militant lifestyle. I think it changes you for that time that you're in, and it can change you for, you know, significant times in your life when you get out. You know, the transition of military service to civilian life is very difficult, and it can be, I mean, even if you never deployed, or even if you were in, I don't know, just had like an easier enlistment than some other service members, it's still a very strong institution that impacts your way of thinking. And in the Marine Corps, I would say is one of the most extreme examples, where it's not only a culture, but it's a mindset, where you're, you know, trained to live in a certain intensity. So I think, long story short, maybe, you know, military service is definitely going to have an effect on you in positive and negative ways. I, you know, there's no way around it. You know, hearing loss or bad knees or, you know, or worse, PTSD are things that, that are common. But if you took an 18-year-old and said, you're going to cut trail in North Cascades National Park with, you know, 12 of your peers for a summer, and then next summer you're going to go and do this in the Everglades and remove invasive species or something like that, can be just as a positive impact, and without the risk of, I guess, damaging your emotional stability.
Yeah, damaging your emotional stability, or, you know, training for violence, which I think inherently, you know, has its own things that come with it. But you did when you were in there, you got to see a lot of places that I know a lot of people wouldn't necessarily get to experience, especially if they, you know, a lot of people in America, they never leave their state or the two states next to them. And a lot of that's because of income inequality and other reasons, but most people don't travel that much. And you got to live Camp Lejeune, I believe, North Carolina, and Pendleton in California, and you were in Okinawa, Japan, and then you served in Iraq. And I guess, what do you think seeing all these places did for you? And do you think there was a difference in seeing them while enlisted versus what you would have got out of traveling there on your own? And have you been back to any of those places?
I haven't been to the overseas locations. I haven't been back to Camp Lejeune either. I drove by it. But that was on my way to a national park to camp for the week. So I will visit again just because of the memories. There absolutely would be a different experience if I were to visit Okinawa as a tourist. I would probably have a lot more fun as a tourist. But to visit Iraq, at least the places that I went as a tourist, I wouldn't imagine would be very enjoyable. You know, it would really be, you know, a different mindset, a different perspective. And when I was there, it wasn't like the thrill of traveling to Iraq. It was, we have a job to do. This is where we're going to be for the next 7 months. Seeing those places, seeing different cultures, was incredibly impactful for me, in Okinawa, especially, from a cultural point of view. Learning about World War II and all the things that kind of went around there on that island, and visiting mainland and even Iwo Jima, which was one of the most powerful experiences of my life. You know, going to Iraq was definitely different. And it wasn't so much of like learning the culture and learning things that way. It was really seeing the consequences of war, and not there to help remediate the consequences. So
you didn't feel we were supporting the people there? Would you say we were supporting Iraq or helping? Was it a helpful war? Has it been? It's still going on.
Yeah. Doesn't seem that way. You know, I'm not, honestly, even though I had spent 7 months of my life there, and you know, as a naive, I'd say 17-year-old was really when I had that, like, I'm enlisting, and then 3 days after my 18th birthday I enlisted, so I didn't need like parental consent or signatures. But at the time of my enlistment, it was, this is, you know, we're going to, you know, help democratize this nation, we're going to get rid of terrorists that are plotting against us and all these things. After, you know, 10 years, 15 years of being there, 20 years, doesn't seem like much has changed or nothing's getting better. But I also don't keep up with it. I haven't read any of the books of my generation that have come out, of, I guess, like my colleagues or fellow service members that were there with me at that same time. So
no, that's you know, good. Over,
yeah.
I mean, I considered enlisting back when I was 18 too. There was a lot of, pro-American, propaganda and sentiment. And as an 18-year-old, you're really caught up in that. And I don't think we were, you know, thinking beyond that. And I didn't end up joining, but I respect you for your decision. And I'm really glad, however, that I didn't decide to do that. I don't think I was ready to make that decision. And I don't necessarily think the path of violence is in line with who I am. And I'm not saying it is with you either, but you were training for violence against other humans. So it's inherent in that decision. And I think a lot of people sign up because they get the opportunity to use guns and possibly, play with violence. I don't know how you feel about that, but I guess, do you feel offensive military actions can ever really support humans? Do we support humans by engaging in war?
No. My biggest takeaway from service is honestly, like, diplomacy has got to be the way. Talk it out. I know, like, some of these conflicts are like millennia long, you know, like 1,000-year issues, bigger than sharing a cup of tea, you know, in a palace to figure out our differences. But it takes time, and I just don't see how it's productive to send people off to kill one another for whatever reason. It gets complicated if it's vengeful, if it's, you know, like 9/11 happens, like, we're going to get back at the people who did this. These are big questions, but you know, the grand scheme of things, we do, like, it's just violence against other humans. It's sad. It's very sad. It's heartbreaking. And, I hate to think about it.
Yeah, there's a lyric from a John Butler Trio song, and the lyric goes, "I don't understand how one can kill a man in the name of peace. That's ridiculous." And I think that kind of goes in line with what we're talking about here. But anyways, thank you for diving into that. I really do appreciate it, and I will jump on to a slightly separate topic. So then, after you got back, switching into civilian life, how did you find your experience of coming back into civilian life, of living in Chicago in your mid-20s after having been an enlisted man, getting used to following orders, needing to follow orders, being incredibly regimented, and essentially what you do is you sign away some freedoms in joining, and you actively chose to do that, but then you got all those rights back, and the rights of freedom that we all talk about here, civilian life. It's so great. You even talked about earlier privileges of being an American, and you felt about this. So what's it like transitioning back? Did you get some of those privileges back? What are those privileges that you were talking about?
I did get those privileges back. I'd say, for one, like, you and I, we took an epic road trip. We drove straight from San Francisco to my first college course. Do you remember that?
I do. That was at the back end of the road trip because we needed to get you back in time. I believe we took 30-something hours to get
36
there.
Hours.
Yeah, man.
Like, it was nonstop. So that's a privilege that you don't have in the military. You know, you have... So if I have a 4-day weekend, right, we call it a 96 because it's 96 hours. We have a radius of miles that we're allowed to travel within that those are rules. And if you drive outside of that radius without permission, then you're out of bounds and you can get in trouble for what, you know, whatever. So, I mean, that's a privilege, like to go where the hell you want, when you want, without permission. I mean, that's a really simple example. And also to just kind of do whatever the hell I wanted. You know, that was a ton of fun. But it, you know, it was interesting to be on that road trip and then where we were relatively unstructured. I feel like you wouldn't have been able to tell that I had ever served in the military on that road trip. It was when I was placed back into a structured environment is when I really started to have these deep feelings of overwhelm and anxiety and of not belonging. So the transition, right, that's like a capital T, being placed back into a structure is where I started feeling these, you know, the sense of overwhelm and anxiety, depression, you know, were just problems with, you know, with me inside. Also like quite a significant identity crisis as I was trying to navigate, interacting with my classmates, in college and interacting with even like my dog Chillingworth back home. You know, I would lash out, not like physically, but you know, I would get flustered inside and wouldn't understand why things weren't the way they should be. Why isn't the dog listening? Why are my classmates talking over the teacher? Things like that. And it just, you know, there was no outlet. There was no way, there was nowhere for me to go to really get help, to navigate my feelings like this. And a few times, like it did boil over. I'll recall a specific moment where, this was biology class. The professor is trying to get things going and the students are being 19-year-olds. And the professor is being patient and all this, but like, I was getting like fuming red, and I literally like slammed my fists on the desk and started yelling at every single student, to shut the fuck up and let the professor like do his job. Like it was really, you know, and once I cooled down, it was embarrassing. That's not who I am, but that's who I was in the Marine Corps, where you have to do those things to get people in line. So I was really like, that's not acceptable. You don't do that in the classroom. This was not the military. This was community college. And I was there to get my GPA up so I can go to a 4-year university. So it's just, it was tough. And those things didn't really succeed in, you know, for a few years. I navigated all of college with a hard time of making friends and getting along with my classmates and even getting along with some professors, you know, all the while kind of, you know, eventually going through the VA system and, you know, the first thing they'll do is medicate. You know, they put you through all the consults, you talk to this doctor and, they put you through the cycle, and the bottom line is you're going to end up on some pills. And they never really took hold for me. I took them, but I just never felt it effective or really worth taking, because there was no impact. I was having problems. And it wasn't until, I want to say like early in my career, when I was working downtown and I was again like having some really big issues, I could not make, I had a hard time getting along with one of my first supervisors. I had a hard time getting along with other people in my peripheral, and I just wasn't able to connect with others. You know, I made a couple of friends, but I was just in an unhealthy job for me, and had a couple of panic attacks, and it, you know, I ended up getting like, you know, some more serious medication, but I just kind of like popped this question to my psychiatrist one day and I asked, like, well, can't meditation help for something like this? Like, can't I learn to calm myself down? Are there other ways besides medicine? And he goes, oh yeah, you should talk to this doctor who's literally across the fucking hall. I went through like a 6 or an 8 week, like, in, you know, program with this guy, and he taught me how to breathe. And he taught me how to visualize my heart rate and how to visualize tranquility and really just, you know, we monitored my heart, you know, all the time. And I was able to literally, like, and I could feel my heart going up, and I could will it back down. So I learned these really amazing skills without having to take meds. Shortly after that, I quit my job and kind of started this different journey. But all that is like, you know, that's the transition. It's like, oh, I'll adjust. Luckily, I had, I'll consider myself significantly more lucky than a lot of service members when they come home, because I came home to, you know, I had stable housing with my mother or my father. I had a really supportive group within family and within friends like you, and, you know, dozens more. And eventually I was able to bring a couple of buddies that I served with to live with me in Chicago. And we all went to different colleges, but we all studied together in the same apartment in Lakeview. And so we had each other. And even with as many, I guess, as good of a scenario as you can have for a transitioning service member, there's still a lot of issues. You know, and a lot of people don't have that. But, you know, I have an amazing network and an amazing group of friends that kind of set the example. This is me outside of college. Like, I went to college and now I'm here. Now I'm a CPA, or I'm in real estate, or I make movies. Really cool paths that, you know, just kind of set the example. I was able to really follow in footsteps. But inside, I was really dealing with complete directionless.
Yeah. Well, you're awesome, and we're all glad how you turned out, man. So going back to those times where you're struggling, though, and when you slammed on the desk in a college classroom, and it's like, who the hell are you? Anger is not really a successful communication tool, I don't think. And so it's interesting that sounds like there was a lot of anger and frustration. Maybe it was the transition, or maybe it was things you had seen, or maybe the way you were taught that didn't align with who you are underneath, or whatever it was. You know, it was coming out in not necessarily the healthiest ways. And after being put on some pills, and I've been put on pills too before. I've been on antidepressants and like different ones in my 20s, because I thought that could possibly help. And for me, they just kind of numbed me. They didn't actually like help. I just felt like less of an array of emotions. And it for, you know, for me, therapy was really helpful in talking it through. And I felt like actually talking through my problems and working on them was more effective than trying to mask the range of emotions that comes from dealing with them. And your therapy, when you ask the questions, which is frustrating that you have to ask the questions, right? Like, shouldn't therapy or breathing, literally, they taught you how to breathe. But how powerful is breathing and meditation? And why don't we try that first or in conjunction with, as opposed to being driven by pills to solve things in our society? It's just unfortunate, because I think a lot of first response to whatever problem it is, whether you're transitioning and having depression or anxiety, or one of our many millennial people experiencing depression and anxiety, and people that are dissatisfied with life, I think pills, you know, are often prescribed as a first answer and as an answer in general. And, you know, not to demonize them, but they are just drugs. Pills are drugs. And there has been some promising work with PTSD, with psychedelics, and I'm not saying you had PTSD, but psychedelics, you know, have shown MDMA and psilocybin in certain studies to aid in that therapy work and going deep down. Do you feel psychedelics might be a helpful tool for whether it's transitioning soldiers or just the population that has reached age 25 and wants to willingly experience substances and find different things? It's legal in Oregon now to do psilocybin. How do you feel about that?
I mean, I'll say it. I'll start with one. It is another drug, but it's administered differently. You know, it's not a prescription that you'll take every day at this time with meals or whatever. You know, it is, it's an interesting evolution in how they're being used. You know, and I think, you know, as a youngster, if you're exploring these kinds of substances, you might be doing it just because you want to have a thrill or a good time and get messed up. But if you have the, you know, the awareness to think that this might help me, you know, find new perspective, or, you know, as you've probably seen in like movies that have it, you know, from the 70s or 60s where folks are saying, expand your mind. You know, that is a very real, you know, it's very apt for that kind of experience. So, I mean, I think there is a lot to gain from it. I don't think it's for everybody, but I mean, if people are willing and it can be administered safely, like, why not? You know?
Yeah, I do. And so now this is going to be fun to loop in here. Because you mentioned gaining perspective and expanding your mind. And you posted something on social media this morning. it's from the Muir Woods National Monument, John Muir. Muir Woods, Queer Woods. I'm going to read it, if that's
sure.
Okay.
Of course.
Muir Woods is highlighting queer ecology and the new perspectives it gives us in the forest. Queer ecology is the study of reimagining how people think about nature. It studies gender, sexuality, and behavior in the natural world. Queer ecology questions the way people categorize nature into binaries or boxes. Oftentimes, these boxes don't account for how diverse nature is. Things are rarely as simple as either A, B, or C. Nature is more of a blend of them all. Some boxes queer ecology challenges are male-female, natural-unnatural, and human-slash-nature. As you explore the woods today, we hope you find new ways to view the world around you. When was a time you saw something in a new light? And I read this, and I immediately thought about a quote from Ram Dass. Do you know who Ram Dass is?
No.
So Ram Dass is formerly Richard Alpert or Alpert, who was the other Harvard professor with Timothy Leary.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. It's familiar.
LSD. Yeah. And the quote that I'm going to read to you is, when you go out into the woods and you look at trees, you see all these different trees, and some of them are bent and some of them are straight. And some of them are evergreens, and some of them are whatever. And you look at the tree and you allow it. You see why it is the way it is. You sort of understand that it didn't get enough light, and so it turned that way. And you don't get all emotional about it. You just allow it. You appreciate the tree. The minute you get near humans, you lose all that. And you are constantly saying, you are to this, or I'm to this. That judgment mind comes in. And so I practice turning people into trees, which means appreciating them just the way they are. Have you heard that quote before?
I feel like you read it to me recently.
Really?
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Turn them into trees. And but that's exactly right. We do have this habit or a response to people for being a certain way. But that's just the way they are.
Yeah.
Just move on with your life. Let them be, you know?
Sounds like you were a little angrier at a certain point and now you're not. And you do spend more time in the trees and with the trees and you breathe and they're very simple things, but how do you feel like connection with nature has helped shape who you are and how did that begin for you? Because obviously now you take people out into the woods. I've been out into the woods with you many times. Talk about connection with nature.
I mean, to connect with nature, to reconnect with nature is to bring yourself back to your core being, right? To be a human being in your natural habitat. And that doesn't mean, you know, be barefoot and live in a tree bark lean-to. You know, this is just like the simple act of being outdoors and appreciating and just existing outdoors, even for just 5 minutes. The impact connected to nature has had in my life is that this is probably the most profound impact, period. You know, more profound than my military service, more profound than, you know, the love for my partner. So the connecting to nature really kind of, I want to say, without giving a whole life story, I grew up, you know, where I grew up, there were forest preserves nearby. I didn't live like in the woods. I lived in the suburbs. But I always loved being outside. I wasn't a video game kid. You know, I grabbed a skateboard or grabbed a bicycle and I'd go off, and play. And having this really deep curiosity for the outdoors and thinking like, well, what's behind the tree line or what's over that hill? How deep is that lake? These are things that always occupied my mind. I would look out the window driving to my grandparents' house, you know, nonstop, or like nature shows, National Geographic, like that shit just like got me. And as I aged into like, you know, my late teens and into my service, you know, that kind of tapers off. But there were moments in my service where I was just like enthralled by being outdoors. You know, if it was taking a helicopter from our base to Alkheim or something and seeing like nothing but totally flat desert for, you know, 2 hours, and then seeing just like these three tiny little plateaus pop up and like around halfway, and just like seeing these really neat landmarks and just wondering why are those there, and everything else is like super flat, just kind of like getting lost in the environment, or like even like being on fire watch, you know, during training exercises, and it's 2 in the morning, it's 40 degrees, it's a clear night, and you have these beautiful stars and the moon and coyotes or chirping in the background or whatever. It's just you know, it brings you back to who you are, at least to who I was. And it was just like, man, this place is fucking cool. You know, and there were times where we'd be, you know, training and there'd be a sign, you know, out there that would say caution quicksand. And I was like blown away by that. Like, holy shit, like I need to go see this shit. Of course I never could because there was, you know, gotta do this, gotta do that. But stuff like that. And once I came home, you know, we went on this road trip. We camped the whole time, unless we were staying with some pals. And, you know, I started to really get myself back, you know, Aaron Wolf and not Corporal Wolf. You know, the Corporal Wolf was in the classroom pounding on the desk like a jerk. Aaron Wolf is like looking at Lake Superior, you know, in the middle of 50,000 acres of old growth forest. So experiences like that really brought me back to who I was as a child, but who I am as a human being. And as I progressed through my transition and having hard times in the city and having hard times at my office, I would take as much time as I could to get outside if it was renting a car, we've done that a couple of times. If it was borrowing a car from one of our parents or whatever it took to get out is what I did so I could be me and not who I thought I had to be or who I was being forced to be, you know, through, you know, the pigeonholed persona of being like the only veteran on, you know, in a team of 300, you know, it's just, it's so, the connecting to nature was absolutely pivotal. And, it's not that I have a special, I don't know, a skill for connecting outdoors. It's that, you know, it just kind of called to me, but I'm not different than anybody else. Anybody can have this connection if you just expand your mind or give it a chance to find something that you enjoy outdoors. It doesn't have to be backpacking in the backcountry. It can be laying in a hammock in the summertime and watching the clouds go by. It can be something really simple as gardening or having a little herb garden on your windowsill. These are things that will bring peace and purpose, peace of mind. I mean, anything. But it's not that, you know, there's a special gift to connecting to nature. This is where we come from. We are people of the planet. We're not people of America or people of Guatemala or China or anything like that. We're human beings. We come from the same place. And over the last 400 years, 600 years, depending on where you're coming from, we have completely lost this connection to nature. And this is where we are, you know, overconsumption and waste and environmental catastrophe and crimes against each other.
It's depressing, the losing connection with nature and then the things that you're then connecting to why we're doing them, because possibly we've lost our connection with nature, and we really have, and there are ways to get it back, and they're very simple, and just like breathing was such a simple thing and we do it all the time, but we never intentionally breathe, or until we figured that out, we don't realize that that can be a tool to help us regaining that connection with nature. I think can also be a tool, and you're right, it doesn't need to be I'm going deep into the woods for 2 weeks and kind of rediscover something primal about me. Like, I'm gonna go to the park, I'm gonna take a walk outside, and disconnect from the screens and reconnect with everything that's going on out there. You really did have like a get out there no matter what kind of mentality with going out into the woods, regardless of how much money you had. So it really must have called you. And not everyone listens quite as deeply or understand where they're being called. But last quote of the moment, because I found another one and I thought of me, but then I thought of you, because I realized like it's more than what it says. I think it's a little deeper than that. And I'm going to mispronounce his name. So sorry for anyone that might be listening, because I don't know how to pronounce the philosopher Diogenes. The philosopher Diogenes was eating bread and lentils for supper. He was seen by the philosopher Aristippus, who lived comfortably by flattering the king. Said Aristippus, "If you would learn to be subservient to the king, you would not have to live on lentils." Said Diogenes, "Learn to live on lentils, and you will not have to be subservient to the king." And I thought of you because you lived in your van for a little bit of time. And I don't know many people who have actually done that. I guess just Toth, who lived on a drop zone, but I, you know, fewer people I know have made the jump from brick and mortar to I'm living on wheels because I'm trying to do what I love. And I think that drive helped you manifest where you're at today. But like that drive allowed you to connect with nature. And so I just find that really cool. How did you feel about making the jump from brick and mortar to on wheels? Because a lot of people are homeless right now. A lot of people are going homeless right now.
Yeah.
This country is in a really bad way, and people can't pay their rent, and people are going out. And you did it by, you know, choice, but also not choice. Like if you had the money, I bet you would have paid for a brick and mortar. Maybe, I don't know. What can you talk about a little bit?
Yeah, it was absolutely choice. It was the summer. My roommates and I were one was going to law school, another was staying put, and I was going on a fucking road trip, period. I had a bunch of stuff I did not need, did not want. I donated everything. If it were a financial issue, I would have sold shit for sure. There were couches, there was a 50 something inch television, is all given. And I moved everything into storage, including the benches to my van, and built a bed and a little cooking area, and a latrine of sorts. And hit the road for several months. It was the time of my life. Absolutely some of the most memorable places that I've ever been, and memorable people. But when I came home or came back to Chicago, it was just more or less, man, like, I'm fine. I don't need to be in an apartment. It was definitely strange to be van lifing in a city. But I did it. And at some point, eventually I began working for, a forest preserve district up in Northern Illinois, and made more sense to just live up there in a house with colleagues, more or less. But I didn't reacquire the stuff.
Yeah. You know? So does that quote, do you feel like it connects with you? Learn to live on lentils and you will not have to be subservient to the king. The king
definitely
being the corporate world that you were, you know, yeah. not an actual man in a chair necessarily, right, that we bow, right, to, but the,
right,
the culture almost that we are a part of, and everyone seems, right, to be working in.
Well, I think, you know, the big takeaway here is you start a business, unless you've got investors and go like the big fancy route, like get ready for, you know, like literally not making money until your shit's figured out. So that's, you know, that's where it makes sense. Like, you know, again, when I started the business, there was a level of naivety that I was not thinking about, or I wasn't thinking about, you know, how just forecasting the duration of expenses before profit. So, you know, the adult things are the things that you should talk to somebody about if they're going to start a business, you know. And I had, my business plan was rock solid, so solid that they gave me all the money and all these things, but projections in a business plan are complete crap. They're just, it's wishful thinking on steroids. I wouldn't have lent money for this business model, dude. And everyone, and I love the organization that lent me the money. I'm still in touch with them. But if any of them had any experience in my industry, they'd be like, this isn't going to work. And I'd never operated my business to the model that I presented to the lender, ever, not even close. So
doesn't matter. You're still here today.
Yeah, I know. And it's like, it's just like, it's a much better business model than I wrote in 2014.
I think there has to be a lot of, you know, learn and adapt when it comes to starting a business. And
for sure. For sure.
You know, it's, yeah, that organization that gave you the loan, great organization, helping small business owners, Axione. And yeah, I'm glad you were able to, because now it's 5 years later and you're still doing it. You've learned to live on lentils, and in doing so, you mentioned the privilege that you think you enjoyed the most in transitioning was your freedom of movement. The freedom to not have someone tell you where you need to be and where you need to go. And even in a corporate world that only provided 2 weeks vacation, or even if you could take more unpaid or whatever it was like, you were still beholden to someone else. And so I think what you've done now maximizes your freedom of movement privilege, which it sounds like is in line with what you need to be the fullest Aaron Wolf that you can possibly be.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Freedom of movement. I wish my buddy was heard you say that. His motto is it's movement is life. He might be, maybe I'll make an introduction down the road. But hell of a guy. And yeah, man, freedom of movement. When I do have to be somewhere for work, you know, it's like, if you distill what I'm doing down to its most basic form, it's I'm going to go backpacking with people. I'm going to share my passion with people who have never done this before, or who are curious about being in the mountains or swimming in a wild river or whatever. And when I come back, even though I might have some equipment to clean, or I've got, you know, someone that I've got to, you know, help out with some gear, whatever I have to do once I get back, I'm always beaming with positivity because of the connections I've made, the relationships I've made, and watching other people blossom into human beings by simply being outside for a few days without disruption. And man, is it fun.
Yeah. So you, just to repeat, get positive connections watching others grow while being outside in nature. So this pandemic must be incredibly difficult, as we've lost the ability to connect with each other, to hug each other. People were wearing masks now, and you can't even see people smile. And I think a smile goes a real long way, and this inability to see people's facial expressions when we even are out. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think it cultivates more fear and less positivity than you can show with the face. You can also show anger and a whole slew of emotions, but I think that positive, you know, goes a long way. And sometimes when you smile, another person just smiles for no other reason. How do you feel like the pandemic has changed you and your behaviors, and how has it impacted your business?
How has it changed me and my behaviors? Obviously, like, I'm doing less in public. You know, I'm not going to restaurants, even though they might be open. You know, I'll maybe like once or twice since this whole thing's been out have I taken the, you know, that opportunity. But otherwise, you know, I'm uninhibited when I'm outdoors. It's a safe place, but it's impacted my business. I mean, immediately the cancellations to our programs, like our benchmark offerings that bring youth outside and bring veterans outside and bring first timers, city folk out into the backcountry, completely wiped out. And not only does that suck from a business point of view, but it sucks it from inside me, because this is robbing me of my opportunity to be with others in a place that I love, to share something that I love, and to watch them soon love that thing as well. So, emotionally it was harder than, you know, than the financial benefits. I think business will recover. You know, I know people are like wanting to get outside more and all this stuff, like that's fine. But, the inability to operate from from a non-fiduciary point of view was like, I think, the hardest. because I look forward to these things. And I have a small team of guides that, you know, lead trips. And if you don't guide in the summer because it's going to be like a high paying job. It's because you love to do it. You love to be outdoors. You love to show others nature and, you know, the same reasons I listed. I've been able to make a career out of it as the founder of the company, but it's just unfortunate when we can't do these things with other people.
Yeah. And to be clear, I absolutely support everyone wearing a mask. I just also support people smiling.
Can I add to that comment? So yeah. We cannot see our smiles. We can't see the teeth, but we can smile with our eyes. We can smile with our voice and we can smile with our body language. And I've got a couple examples of this. I've been working with an organization out here in Western North Carolina, and it's a really busy organization. I talk to the founder regularly. He's very busy and usually somewhat stressed, but I can, you know, with reason when you're a busy individual. I couldn't see him, but I could hear his smile because things were going well. And I told him that. And then when I go, and I mentioned this before, we shop at Publix down the street, man, those people are stoked. And there's one guy who does the produce, and I can't see, he wears glasses, so I usually can't see his eyes because there's a glare. He wears the mask, but his body language says, dude, good to see you. How are you guys? Like it's there. So we might have to be a little more adaptive in how we smile and show our enthusiasm. But, you know, it's something I kind of picked up when I took, American Sign Language in college, which was probably one of the most beneficial classes I took. I wish I had kept up with it because it was such a beautiful thing to learn. It's a beautiful language, and it connects you with people that you would otherwise not have a conversation with, as any language would. But the what's called facial grammar and body language to help you communicate, and it's just, man, it makes sense.
Yeah, that's really cool that you learn to communicate in that different way. You're right. It's just another language, but it specifically uses your facial expressions as well. And so I'm sure that was, you know, really interesting knowledge that you've gained and been able to read people. And you're right. We can smile in other ways. And I think that's really special. So your friend said that movement is life. And maybe I'll talk to this friend one day. But how do you think we best cultivate respect for life? I don't think necessarily the military cultivated respect for life, but maybe you would disagree with me there. Do you think the military does, or do you think there's, regardless of the military, what do you think the best way to cultivate respect for life is? Do you think that's good to cultivate respect for life?
Yeah, of course, good to cultivate respect for life. Better than disrespect for life. The military doesn't cultivate respect for life, but after service, I think in a roundabout way, it does. I think for me, it did afterwards. After seeing, you know, the consequences of war and even like traveling to Israel, where there is great hate on both sides, right? On Iraq, they hate Israel, and in Israel, they hate Muslims or whatever specifics you want to get into, but like on the, you know, black and white is what it is. And when I went to Israel and heard how they're basically, you know, really speaking similarly to how I was hearing Iraqis speak about Israel, I was like, well, there's no fucking difference here. So that was kind of like the turning point, like respect for life. We're so close to each other, but we act as if we're like completely different worlds. So having that perspective of like, you know what, there is no right side here. Like if both sides had their way, there'd be, you know, catastrophic bloodshed. And I think having the opportunity to have traveled to kind of both ends of that spectrum was, you know, helped me cultivate respect for life. How do we best cultivate respect for life? I think we gotta maybe listen, listen to other perspectives. Let's listen to each other. Live a little bit more, live differently, do things that might make you uncomfortable. I mean, there's, you know, make new friends from different cultures. I know it's really fucking cliche and it's hard to do. But I think we broaden our circles and our perspectives by listening to others who have a completely different way of life, different upbringing or different values. And when we see this in politics in America right now, like, right, there's not much that separates Democrats and Republicans. We just want the same things, but it looks different. It sounds different. And it's, man, it's messed up, but you know, we want to have healthcare. We want to have access to food and stable jobs and enough money to make ends meet and live comfortably. There's, you know, that's what we want. But it's not what we got.
Yeah, it's not what we got. But so I'll pull out of what you just said there. We need to actively work on connecting with each other and nature and listen to each other. And listening to nature, I'll add in there. And by actively working to connect and listening with both nature and each other might be the best way, in your opinion, to cultivate respect for life.
Yeah, you know, I didn't even bring up connecting to nature, but I'm glad you did, because that is how I spend my time. And, you know, I've never met a pissed off person on the trail.
You're never angry after your exercise either. You're only before you do it, but you're never, you're never angry after you're doing something that's good for you. Yeah. It's just very difficult to motivate ourselves to do those things sometimes. Yeah. Go ahead.
You know, to that end with, you know, connecting to nature, just being in nature. And again, this isn't saying you have to go to the backcountry or to a national park or anywhere remote. You can go to your backyard and then follow an insect for a couple of minutes. What's it doing? Where's it going? What's its purpose? Or just like, you know, there's a whole new perspective. You know, get down into the dirt with it. Look closely at its exoskeleton. How many legs and its antennae, are they long or do they have big eyes? Just like observing this thing, getting close enough to, I mean, dare I say, appreciate something that you would never have noticed hadn't you spent 2 minutes in your backyard for an insect. That there you can cultivate respect for life just by sitting with something for a couple of minutes.
Yeah, I think I brought in connection with nature, because when I say
I'm glad
life,
you did.
When I say life, you took it in that question to mean, you know, the people that inhabit the planet with us, whether they be Republicans, Democrats, independents, Chinese people, Russian people, Mexican people, you know, all people. And I zoom out a little bit and expand it to all life. How can we cultivate respect for the animals and the plants and, you know, the singular planet that we all live on? And I think it really takes an ego. It takes our ego to think that we are or could possibly be separate from nature and each other, because when you work on breaking down the ego, you realize that we are, you know, interdependent and connected, and that this is one connected system, and what we do one place affects what we do in other places, and even the energy, whether positive or negative, that we give to certain people affects everyone else. A smile goes a long way, anger goes a long way, and it you know, permeates the collective consciousness. But, you know, we said we've lost our connection with nature, which is egotistical thinking in my mind. And as a result of it, some of the externalities that you were talking about earlier, overconsumption and environmental catastrophe, all of the climate change problems that we're currently concerned with. And then we even see systems breaking down in nature when we encroach on it too much, and ecosystems going out of whack, and you know, when we're killing predators and wildlife. How do you think we best address these problems of overconsumption and climate change? Do you think we can address them? Do you think there's still hope?
Yeah, there is hope, and there always has to be hope. Otherwise, fuck it. We're all fucked. Without hope, without optimism, without progress or a vision for progress, nothing is worth living. You have to maintain positivity. That's how entrepreneurs, I think, make it, is that they keep believing, you know, because small business is stupid difficult. The rephrase your question or ask it again. How do we hope? Is there a hope? How do we fight overconsumption?
Because that's both individual and systemic, right? Like, we can take steps, and I'd be curious about what you think those are, but then there's systemic issues, and how do you think we address this whole system?
Yeah. The system, man, that's the big one. You know, it's cultural at this point. So it's, it's cyclical, right? The system feeds the culture, and the culture creates the system, where we need to have more. We need to have the newest phone. We need to have two cars in the garage. We need to have whatever the fuck, you know, we're always buying things. It's coming in plastic, it's being shipped from around the globe. Not that having things from other places is bad, but the amount of resources that go into, you know, these products, whether I don't know, man. Like, the reason I did not reacquire the stuff after my road trip and after van life is because I didn't need it. I did not need a fucking sofa, like a big sofa. Like, sure, something to sit on is fine. A desk is good. A bed is good. But if I'm kind of living lean and then I'm going to move into this house or this apartment, like, so there's already stuff in there, man. I'm just going to use it. Maybe it's different when you own a home and you're going to nest for a while. But, you know, I think if we're able to drive home the impact that we're creating through overconsumption by the immediacy for new products that are coming wrapped in plastic, that are made with, you know, whatever it is, you know, that's the start. But I mean, this is a capitalist society. We grow through the cycle of commercial exchange. You know, I mean, I like the idea of the circular economy quite a bit. I think it can take over in some niche circles, but I don't see it being the answer for American culture at large or Western culture. I mean, or any culture, well, maybe some cultures, but, you know, I think from the individual scale, it's a lot more attainable, and maybe that's how we impact the system, is by making the changes that we can make. You know, it's tough to get legislation written that's going to greatly reduce the amount of plastics we're creating, because there's giant forces against the concept of reducing plastic. But if you at home can decide, I'm never going to, or for the next year at least, I'm going to do my best to bring my reusable mug to the coffee shop, to bring my reusable bag to the grocery store, I'm going to reduce how much I eat that is produced from animals, these are steps that you can take that will over time impact the system that creates overconsumption and waste and pollution. And that's, you know, really, it's a journey. I know you've been down that road and you've really reduced to a great amount your impact on the planet. And I'm on a similar journey. My partner and I are also like largely vegan. I think after our visit, I'll share the news now. She's like, I'm fucking going all in.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah. Yeah. So
wow.
There is impact. You know, and you saw how we live. We weren't,
No, you've made great strides from the meat eating, Chicago
right.
guys and, we used to be.
Yes. The guys we used to be. And, so there have been, you know, huge over time, it's been very gradual, but now, you know, the food we eat, where we get our food, how we prepare it or whatever, it's all pretty lean and I hope to be sustainable, enough, but we're, you know, going all plant-based as best we can, getting rid of the, what remains of, you know, we've had some, I'm an outfitter. I'm always got s'mores materials on hand. So we've got some Malos and some milk chocolate that remain and some honey, that remain. But I think after that, man, we've made those tiny changes, in our dollar, right? This is the one thing that speaks to the system at large. Our dollars are not going to those institutions that create the animal products, that create the plastics, that create the dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico or anything like that. So, over time you create the trend. It's easier to do, I think, as an individual, and to see that trend impact through hundreds of individuals over time than it is to like force it down the government's throat. Because when you create change or legislation or whatever it is that it is for one purpose and not the other, it's a shit show and nothing gets done politically in Congress or in Washington. It's a terrible, this is absolutely the worst time in America for politics. Where nothing gets done and everyone hates each other.
Yeah. So no. So this is great. So let me extrapolate what I heard there. It is necessary to disrupt the system because the current system that we have is leading us on a path which is an existential crisis and not sustainable. We can do our best to be aware of the resources involved in creating the things that we consume, and we can't stop consuming. We're humans, we live on the planet. There's going to be an aspect of consumption, but we can be aware of the resources involved in that consumption and make changes. And
have you seen the I Am documentary?
And it was about the producer of Ace Ventura Pet Detective. Have you heard about this? Or did you ever see
it? I've heard of it. I haven't watched it, but man, Ace Ventura cracks me up.
I know. I love Jim Carrey. And it was, he did Ace Ventura and he did one other Jim Carrey film, back then. I don't think it was The Mask. I can't think of what it was, but, either way, he essentially got rich off of those films. Super wealthy, bought houses, boats, was living the lifestyle, and he was not happy. And he went on an exploration and talked to all the greatest people about
what's wrong in the world and what can we do about it?
What makes us happy in society and how do we achieve happiness? And at the end of the day, there was some aspect of needs versus wants. And at the end of the movie, and I suggest you watch it because it's been a while now and I can't speak to it quite as good. But what I'm pointing out is that he got rid of all of his material wealth that he had gained. And he lived like in a one bedroom apartment with a bicycle, and he shed all of that wealth that he attained, and he donated it because he found that was more in line with happiness, what truly makes us happy. It's not necessarily the material attainment, and he knows because he had it all. And, but you know, you're always kind of hoping for that happiness, but sometimes being minimalist, being aware of our resource consumption, being aware of what we need versus what we want, and sometimes making those decisions in the long term can help make us happier. And there is a feeling, I think, of powerlessness when it comes to climate change. This is such a huge problem. How could we ever possibly affect it? What does anything that I do individually make a difference, especially if the guy right over there is not doing it the way that I'm doing it to be better for the planet? And have you heard of the appeal to futility fallacy?
No.
So the appeal to futility fallacy essentially says that that line of thinking brings us into a world where you would never try to do anything better. You would never act better, because what's the point? Gotcha. It essentially says that my individual change is not going to change the system. The system change is hopeless. Therefore, I should not make any individual change. But the system is just made up of, you know, at this point, 7.8 billion individuals. And any small changes that we make, when you multiply that behavior, actually does make great change. And so to hear that you're both being aware of your resource consumption and that the love in your life is also becoming aware and making those changes, will only build and grow, hopefully, your awareness and then ability to impact others' awareness of such things, and they can make their, you know, own decisions once they're aware of that situation. But we're not really powerless, and boycotts, which is essentially what moving your dollar is, it's changing demand within the system. I'm no longer going to buy animal-based foods. I'm going to buy plant-based foods. I can just purchase the other one, and whoa, my resource consumption goes significantly down. I'm no longer going to buy coffee cups, and I'm going to bring my coffee cup. Really infinitesimal change. But when everybody starts doing that, it's really a huge change. And I wasn't trying to shove it down your throat when we were there. So I really do feel like there was an effective form of communication that happens just by, you know, changing yourself and showing people that you can. And so through that, I think hopefully that might be a way that we can change the culture. Cause you're right, we're not going to legislate this change. Even it's just not going to happen. The only way any real change happens that's good for the people are voter initiatives, where we're allowed to circumvent the legislature.
Yeah.
Correct. For the most part, that's how change that the people want happens. They're a $15 minimum wage, I think, passed in Florida.
Yeah.
In what is it? Oklahoma, South Dakota, Arizona, Montana, New Jersey, and Oregon. There were positive efforts from voter initiatives to end the war on drugs. Some were legalizing cannabis. Some were allowing for psychedelics to be used in Oregon. Yeah. Even District of Columbia voted in that direction. Overwhelmingly, people reject the drug war. They want fair wages. They want people to be taken care of. A Fox News poll said 72% of Americans want government-run healthcare, is how they phrased it. And even on Fox News, 72% of the people want that. And I don't have much hope. It doesn't mean we shouldn't try, but I have less hope in changing the system from within the system. But when we all change as people, I think that can be more powerful, because again, the system is just made up of us.
Right.
So yeah, I sorry to go on a tangent, connecting some things there, but I think it's really cool, and I think it's necessary for us to become aware of these things and make changes personally and have these conversations with our friends and neighbors, even though sometimes they may be difficult. And I think not come from a place of judgment, because, you know, at a certain point, we were consuming lots of resources and completely unaware of how any of our behaviors affected the greater system and how it was all connected. And, you know, we've grown in that way. So I think it's possible for others to as well, you know, if that's the direction they want to grow, you know, they might just have to think of them like trees and they'll just be, and that's okay.
They'll find their way, you know,
they'll find their way. Well, basically, man, I'm grateful for your time here. I think what we should pull out of this today is everyone should listen for smiles because you can hear them. You want to love what you do because you can be the truest version of yourself when that's true. And everyone should go outside and connect with nature and try and connect with each other as much as we can and have good conversations because, yeah, man, that's how we share the love. Thank you for your time.
You got it. Thanks for having me, Josh.
Thanks, man. Later, buddy.
Thank you for listening. I hope you'll join me again. And remember, even a pebble can create many ripples.